Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, TJ Buchholz from Vanguard Public Affairs. Thanks for joining us, TJ.
Hey, thanks for having me in the group. Appreciate it.
So, TJ, you guys got a podcast too now, don't you?
We do. We're doing a little venture into that. Again, I think the more podcasts that are out there, the better, I think, and more informed, I think, the society is. I started listening to Pod Save America. I mean, I've been a big fan of your podcast, obviously, for a long time.
Well, that's why you're here.
For sure. But I've been listening to Pod Save America. A lot of my younger people at Vanguard, they listen to a lot of podcasts. That's how they get their news. So I said, well, let's try one ourselves and see how it goes. We actually do two. We actually do Pod Save Michigan. You know, we're trying for that cease and desist letter. From Pod Save America, where we talk about politics and sort of the Lansing landscape. But then we actually do a second one called Four Under 30, and it gives our millennial staff a voice. And they actually had a really good one this past week about sharing their struggles with student debt from college. It's an issue that I think a lot of millennials are facing. So it's a sort of a two-in-one you get when you listen to our podcast.
Have you paid off your student debt yet, Jacob?
No.
Could have had Jacob on the podcast. He could talk about it.
That's one of my favorite topics to talk about, Kyle.
I remember when I paid off my student debt. I know I was in late 30s, like 38 or something like that. It was such a great occasion. We went out and celebrated. It was wonderful.
I can't even picture what that day's going to look like.
It's going to be fantastic, though. And you'll live to see it. I know it. And it's going to be wonderful.
And you might not even have gray hair.
I think I had some gray hair when the student loan was finally paid. Well, let's talk about something a little bit more immediate here, and that is the budget presentation the governor is going to be laying out. It's on Fat Tuesday. It's never been on a Tuesday before, John.
And I can't remember being on a Fat Tuesday either. Although I've been told by Jacob that this is the latest date they could actually do it under the rules, right?
That's what the new budget director, Chris Kolb, told me, that they are constitutionally allowed to present this late. New governor gets some, I think it's like 60 days after the legislature convenes.
So I wonder if this is going to be like a Mardi Gras party. I mean, are they going to bring hanging out the bead necklaces and stuff? Prescott Rossman just have the Poonchki party right there in the Senate hearing room. And we can just kind of keep the celebration going.
I don't know. Maybe we could get some corporate lobbyists to underwrite the cost of the Poonchkis for the budget presentation.
That would be kind of fun, wouldn't it, TJ?
Poonchki seem kind of heavy for any sort of budget presentation. I'm thinking maybe, you know, something with a balsamic vinaigrette. I don't know.
Oh.
Just to me, if Poonchki seem really, you know, really fattening and sweet for a budget that, you know,
but it's
needs
Fat
to be
Tuesday. You gotta have something fattening on Fat Tuesday.
Well, yeah, maybe on your own time though. But budget presentation really should be maybe a little more stoic.
But is it going to be a fat and sweet budget?
Is it going to be
a situation? That's what I'm watching for. I want to see, is this going to be if this is a wish list budget, then I think things are going to go differently. And by the way, I'm not expecting that. But if it's going to be a well-balanced budget where she's got obvious things where they could be trading and so on and so forth, and it's well-crafted, I think that'll be something that we can kind of look at.
Well, I mean, I think this budget, I mean, the governor sort of alluded to this a little bit in the last couple of weeks. She really has two major priorities, and that's roads, you know, how we're going to fix the damn roads, be a little more detailed tomorrow, and then education, which I think they're already starting to leak out today. You know, certainly going to be, I think from their perspective, a significant investment in Michigan's K-12 system. But you know, there are a lot of issues that need to be addressed. If you talk to any department director in this town, they all have needs. They all have wishes. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, when we talk about the budget, we talk about it from a three-legged stool approach. Roads are obviously a priority. Education is. But also infrastructure. You know, everything from pipes to police and fire services, you know, revenue sharing. That's that third leg that she has said, I think, in some private meetings that's a priority for them that they want to address, but it's not going to be as visible as those two priorities will be tomorrow.
I always see, John, the budget being kind of that starting gate kind of discussion. I mean, you put out the budget, but what you're really doing is you're setting the spending priorities for the coming year. And like TJ said, the spending priority for the roads. And so whatever she puts out for the roads however she moves around the different funds for education, that's what she wants to see addressed. Will it be the exact thing that she puts out?
That's going to be the curious thing, because I think if you think about the makeup of the legislature, you know, and it's her job to propose. It's the legislature's job to dispose, and the Republicans control the legislature. So the question for me is going to be, where does she set the markers, and how does she set the table for negotiating what she actually wants to accomplish? What's going to offend the Republicans right away? What's going to appeal to them? How close does she try to get to sort of a center ground with her proposal? That's all going to be very interesting to watch.
Because it's all crafted in that way. There's going to be some things that she knows the Republicans are going to be like, yes, that's something we can do. And then there's going to be some things like she knows the Republicans won't do. And then there will be some things that are kind of benchmarks that they'll kind of meet in the middle on.
And there's probably things in there she's going to propose that she politically understands are going to be very difficult to accomplish, but she has to propose them because that's just kind of the makeup of politics today.
All right. What are you kind of looking for in this budget presentation, Jacob?
Well, I would just echo what John says. I mean, in terms of what is she going to come out with in terms of her starting point and kind of how she plays it and messages it. Certainly, she can come out with setting the mark, knowing that eventually the final product will be different. But how much is she going to put out in terms of revenue increases, which I'm guessing there would be, that are going to kind of be that non-starter? Are we going to see, you know, increased taxes on business kind of thing? Where are we going to see the revenue for roads? I mean, it'll be very interesting to see where she starts at and kind of how that sets the tone for negotiations with Republicans.
So, Mike, what do you think is a hell no for Republicans, Mike?
Tax increases. It's going to be a hard start to get a tax increase, but I don't know how you fund the roads without additional revenue.
Does she make PA 51 part of the equation, Jack? Reforming PA 51.
Boy, if she does, she better go a long way towards saying this is what I want to do with it, because otherwise you're opening a Pandora's box that can take years to negotiate and never be able to figure out. The only way I would get into there, that if I was a governor, is to say, here's what I want to do with PA 51. I wouldn't want to just open up the box and then, you know, let the Republicans and the, you know, let the legislature play with it, because it's an endless road, and I'm not meaning to just use the word road, but it's an endless road.
It can be so time-consuming and so all-consuming that it could just suck the oxygen out of the room. And what else do you get out of it?
Yeah, another thing I just thought of is in terms of, obviously the governor has a lot of emphasis on roads, but what kind of domino effect is that going to have throughout the budget? As we've been kind of, there's been a public discussion about what to do with roads. Obviously, you talk about the money that's earmarked that goes towards schools. So how are schools affected? You have the PA 51 discussion. In terms of where the road money goes. So it'd be interesting to see how the governor kind of manages the domino effect that is kind of how funds are connected throughout state government, and kind of how she deals with, well, when you take funding from one thing, how does it affect another thing kind of thing.
I think what's interesting from a budget discussion perspective is that when Mike Shirkey took over as Senate Majority Leader, I think he put some bright lines on and things that they wouldn't support. I mean, one of them obviously was, you know, going back and looking at the corporate tax. You know, he's been pretty clear that that's a non-starter for Republicans. You know, but at the same time, he's also, and Speaker Chatfield has as well, said that, you know, that revenue enhancement has to be a discussion, especially if we look at prioritizing fixing the roads. I think that, you know, they're looking at, I think, broader based tax solutions. Certainly the Republicans will be, than just, as Mike said, tax increases, especially probably that, you know, looking at that corporate tax, probably a non-starter.
Okay, we're going to do a yes or no before we go to our next topic here. Will the budget be done by the summer recess, John?
Yes, I'm going to vote yes.
TJ?
I think so. I think the governor was pretty clear in her state of the state that she didn't want to recess until the work was done.
What do you think, Jack?
That was a tough question right after her state of the state, because I would say, do you think it's really going to go on until, you know, August or something? And people, oh, no, what the governor meant was it's going to be done like it's been done. And I took it the other way. It was like, you guys will not leave until it's done. And I'm thinking maybe August.
Okay. Mike, is this budget going to be done by the summer recess?
I think it will. I don't know what it will look like, if it'll be any good, but it'll get done.
What do you think, Jacob?
I say no, especially if the governor wants to tackle these difficult problems like roads in this budget season. I mean, I think it took till it was like 2015 that the transportation package under Snyder was signed. I think if the governor wants to get something in roads in this first budget, I think this is going to take some hard work, and I don't know if it's going to happen before they're done in June?
I'm really waffling on this, but I am going to say yes. And the reason I'm going to say yes is because of the leaders involved. I think the situation is a little different than what we had in the Granholm years with Bishop and Dylan, where they were just hand-wringing to figure out where they were going to cut the budget, and they didn't want to cut it, and they just kept putting off. You know, it's like that task that you don't want to do, and you just kind of keep kicking it down the road until the last possible second, and then you're like, okay, now we really got to do it. I don't think that's the problem here. The problem is it's just making the tough decisions and then cutting the deal. Whether they do it in June, and I understand this is the same thing with Granholm, or that Granholm had to deal with, but whether you make it in June or you make it in September, it doesn't really change the discussion or the pieces on the board. It's the same kind of thing. And I don't get the sense that Shirky and Chatfield are procrastinators.
No, and that's it. It is really up to them, not necessarily up to her, because they can send her a budget and she can deal with it. But
well, and to Jacob's point, which I think is a good one, is it depends on what's on the table on Tuesday. If she has some pie-in-the-sky vision with revenue enhancements across the board, for as much as Shirky and Chatfield have been, I think, really good on message in terms of bipartisan work, if there are some non-starters in that budget that cannot be moved, I mean, you'll see state employees sleeping on the floors of their offices come September 30th.
Next topic of discussion here, Justin Amash, will he run for president in 2020, and I loved your expression over there, Mike. So I'm gonna start over here with you, and just to set this up, let me tee this up here a little bit. Justin Amash has been the most outspoken Republican critic of President Trump that there probably has been, and that has caused him to lose some support in his home district in the 3rd congressional district, particularly among the grassroots former Tea Party people who basically put him in office back in 2010. Now, with Trump at the top of the ticket in 2020, or presumably so, Justin Amash could be in a situation where he would face a primary, and there's already scuttle about getting somebody to run against Amash on a one-on-one, a pro-Trumper against Justin Amash one-on-one in 2020. So, with that backdrop and the potential of him losing some kind of financial support within his home district, is an idea of running for president kind of a now or never kind of situation?
Well, anybody can run for president. I'm not ruling out a run for president in 2020. Just so y'all know. That's my announcement for today.
Hey, we got a story.
but does he? I just don't see that he has a shot at it.
It's a pixie dust and unicorn story.
Yeah. Okay. Jack, what do you think?
Well, I don't want to run, but I won't count. You know, I won't absolutely take it off the calendar and say I absolutely won't do it.
I mean, if you win the lotto and you get like a couple, $100 million, shoot, you could try it.
And I need all the grief that would go with it too, right? But really, I mean, yeah, I'll make the prediction he'll run and he will take enough votes in Michigan away from Trump to give the state to the Democrats.
Okay, so Jacob, let's talk about why Justin Amash would want to run for president. It would expand his universe of support. Now, he does have some very diehard support. If he could take that message nationally and get some national funders behind him and kind of elevate his message, be the anti-Trump person out there who's promoting fiscal responsibility, individual liberties, that's a message that could fly, and he may not be the next president, but it raises his profile to a national level. You could argue that he's too big of a fish in his fishbowl right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think so he's talking about a third party, right? And so the first thing that comes to mind is libertarian. I would say that his profile among libertarian candidate, I mean, he would shoot to the top in terms of name ID, in terms of people among libertarians. I mean, even better than a Gary Johnson. So I think that he has a lot of national, he could draw a lot of national support with kind of this brand that he's built. I think, in charge of the Liberty Caucus, yeah. Right? And, kind of his presence on social media. So I think certainly he could draw support from all over based on kind of the track record he's built.
Who was the 2016 nominee for the Libertarian Party?
Gary Johnson.
Okay.
From New Mexico. All right, TJ, your thoughts on this?
Amash is going to do it, and he's got nothing to lose. I mean, it's, I agree with you. It's, yeah. I mean, he announces that he's running for president as an opposition to Trump, insulates himself in his district to some extent, especially with anti-Trump Republicans who he needs to, them to vote for him, especially if Dems put up a strong candidate in the third. It increases his name ID, it increases his money levels. I think it's a bit of a fool's errand, really, but at the end of the day, he'll do it. He's got nothing to lose, and he can demonstrate on a national stage that there are Republicans, especially those in the sort of libertarian, sort of Liberty Caucus area who think that he's got a chance at it, or again, at least he can make a claim against Trump on a lot of issues.
Explain to me, though, why you would give up a congressional seat.
He doesn't have to.
For a chance to. He doesn't. He can run and do both same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, well, until he's no longer a candidate.
Right.
I mean, he could be a candidate for president right now. He doesn't have to give up his congressional seat. So, I mean, let's just say he continues being a candidate until exactly a year from now, and then he decides, I'm no longer a candidate anymore. But he's already raised money and whatever.
Assuming, though, he runs for the Libertarian ticket, don't you think the odds are he's going to get it?
Again, he probably would. But, again, it doesn't change any of his calculus in terms of staying a congressman. I mean, he can go and put some lines in the water and see what he gets, see what support he gets, see what money he gets, and can always pull the plug on it if it's not working. But but what he's really interested in is his name ID. He's really interested in that national name ID, and he'll get that certainly in the first few months for sure.
And if he boosts his name ID and then still loses his congressional race, he's got the book deal afterward. He's got all the different appearances he can make on national shows, et cetera, and he's got a future. He's very young still, so.
Yeah, I mean, he could be kind of that centerpiece of, I don't know what you would call it, like libertarianism. I mean, I don't think Justin Amash would run out of business opportunities he could do if. And let's think about this, John. I mean, he could stay in Congress, but to what end? You know, he's already kind of proven the points that he's going to be proving. He's not convincing anyone to his line of thinking. It's not like he's a leader in the Republican conference in Washington, D.C. He doesn't have a band of followers among the insiders. I don't know if he's got anything left to prove there.
I guess you're right. I just the more I think about it, it's when you think about these third-party ticket candidates, they have a flash bang for a period of a matter of months, and they're disappear from the scene forever.
Well, I mean, and I don't know that Amash is, you know, if, let's pretend for a second that he gets the Libertarian nod for president. I don't know that Justin Amash carries many more votes than the Libertarian nominee did last cycle.
Right.
So, I mean, but I think to Jack's point, I think it's a broader-based conversation about for Justin Amash. You know, what's his future path? Where is he going to go? Does he want us to be the congressman of the 3rd District forever? I mean, I think the answer to that is no.
No, I agree.
But where does he go? And I think that in any scenario you paint here, his name ID increases, his money increases, and that gives you more opportunities.
Well, we're going to move the conversation now to not Justin Amash. We're going to move it to Bo Lefave and Northern Michigan and the UP, and we'll bring Bo in right now. Joining us now in MERS World Headquarters is the state representative from the Upper Peninsula, Bo Lefave. Bo, thanks for joining us here in MERS World Headquarters.
It's a pleasure to be here. Glad to finally make it into the building. It's a gorgeous place here.
Well, I appreciate that. So first thing we've got to ask you about is the snow. Compare the snow in the UP to any other winter.
I'll tell you, if this is what global warming means, we probably should do something about it because there is too much snow. There is way too much snow up there. US-2 was closed down for 36 hours because of 12-foot drifts. It's bad. Representative Markkinen and Cambenzi had to come south to my district to drive over, added an extra hour and a half onto their drive just to get south of the bridge.
Is this the worst you've seen it?
It's the worst I've seen it, but I was born like 6 months ago, so it's not much to compare to. But no, I'm 26. This is the most snow I've seen, but it's not as cold as it's ever been in my memory.
So are they like digging tunnels and stuff to get cars through? I saw somebody jump out of his front door and into the snowdrift.
Yeah, that's not in South Central Upper Peninsula. That's more in Representative Markkinen's district.
Okay.
And it's a traffic issue too, isn't it? We were up there on President's Day weekend, and you really had to be careful pulling out of an intersection because the snow's piled so high you can't see anything.
Yeah, you really can't. It teaches you to look for cars before you get to the intersection. and then you go slowly, and then when you finally get the gumption, you just step on the gas and hope and pray.
Oh, my gosh.
But usually, it's the UP, usually there isn't a car there. So I don't want to say flip a coin, more like throw a 36-sided die and hope you don't land on 36.
All right. Well, you're heading back up there, and I'm sure that will be a longer journey as usual. So we'll try and get you out of here. But a couple things going on that we want to get your opinion on. The Democrats, led by Robert Wittenberg, is reintroducing the red flag laws, and those are the bills that give people more power to alert authorities when they feel like somebody close to them could be a danger to themselves or others, and they have a CPL license or they have access to guns. Wanted to get your opinion on these bills.
Well, I certainly appreciate Representative Wittenberg talking about issues that are important to him and are important to the state of Michigan. We do need to have a discussion about how we can make people safer and make sure that people have access to their Second Amendment. And we can, with due process, adjudicate people and take their rights away to get them the health care that they need. I will mention that Representative Wittenberg, I should really thank him again. 15 days before my first election, he dropped an assault weapons ban and a magazine restriction ban. That boosted me over the top and helped me get into the seat that I'm in.
Well, so, what do you mean? How did that help you?
Well, as it turns out, people in the UP don't like the idea of taking guns away from law-abiding citizens. And unfortunately, once again, this bill will take guns away from law-abiding citizens without due process of law. If it's the same bill that he introduced last session, that bill has no due process rights for the accused. Somebody can walk into a courthouse and say, Kyle Malin just threatened to shoot my head off, and he's a good friend of mine, and the cops can do a no-knock search warrant and take all the weapons, and then you got to go to the judge and say, I didn't say that. I'm not crazy, I swear. And there's ex parte hearings. It's a real problem. So the bills as written are a no-go for people that are concerned about due process rights under the Fourth Amendment and obviously the Second Amendment rights.
Now, on the other hand, you have dropped a bill today, and we're taping on Thursday here, regarding allowing teachers and substitutes to have some extra protection in the classroom.
Yes. My bill would allow a local school district to pick and choose individual employees of the district to have pepper spray and or tasers.
Is pepper spray not legal to carry in schools now? I mean,
we have what are called weapons-free zones, and you can kind of get around the weapons-free zone with a concealed pistol license. It's a little bit complicated, but basically, if you don't have a CPL, it's still a weapons-free zone, which means you can't have any weapons, including pepper spray.
Really? Could they have them on their person, or would they have to lock them in a desk, or what would they have to do here?
The bill is silent on that, because I think that that decision is best made at the local level. This bill simply gets rid of the criminal statute at the state level, making it illegal to carry pepper spray or tasers. Now, tasers are a little bit special in that the state law still says you need to have a concealed pistol license and 1 hour of training on tasers. So you need to have an FBI background check, your fingerprints on file with the local police department, 9 hours of training and 100 rounds down range to get that. In addition to that, local school districts would be able to put things into their contract saying no teacher shall either A, have a weapon on school, or B, if a teacher has pepper spray, it must be to the best ability possible locked in a drawer at all times, or kept within 5 inches of the teacher, or whatever the rulings might be. Or they might just say, hey, our gym teacher, Miss Kavanaugh, was served in Iraq, and she certainly has the training and expertise. She can have a taser. Nobody else can.
Where does this bill come from?
I was in my district talking to five older ladies who are probably didn't vote for me. I know they didn't vote for me the first time, and I don't think they voted for me the second time. And they're very, very mad at me that I think that teachers should be able to not shed their Second Amendment rights at the schoolhouse gates. And I said, you know, I want to arm teachers because I think that's the best way to keep criminals out of schools is to threaten to shoot them if they come in with guns. Seemed reasonable to me. These little ladies really didn't appreciate that idea. And I was just exacerbated. And I said, you got to agree with me that these are dangerous areas. And I said, yes, something needs to be done. I said, can I at least give them pepper spray? And all five of the ladies looked at each other. And one of them says, yes, that's a great idea. And I thought, oh my gosh, I think we've solved it. So I think we might have a consent here that's something less than lethal. I always say that if, God help us, if a little kid gets a hold of this pepper spray, somebody's going to have a very bad day, but nobody will die.
You know, last time Rick Jones introduced the taser bill, he got tasered in a House committee. Would you agree to get tasered in a House committee?
That sounds like quid pro quo. I'm not really interested in, no, I don't know. That sounds difficult. I don't know about that. Rick Jones is...
What if it gets your bill moved, though?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one.
Would you do it if Rick Jones agreed to be tasered again?
I would probably agree to taser Rick Jones. That sounds like fun.
I wouldn't be surprised if he'd be willing to do that.
That would be the most fun. No respect to my good Senator Rick Jones. God bless you, my friend, if you're listening. I don't know. I had a couple members ask me the same question, and I gave them the good old line about, that sounds like quid pro quo. I'm not going to entertain that discussion.
Huh. Well, but if it doesn't get moved to your committee, then, you know, anything could happen on that.
Certainly. No, and those bills are actually referred to the Committee on Judiciary. I think we might re-refer those. Maybe we won't. But I'm the vice chair of the Judiciary Committee, so... I have every confidence in the world that we'll have both Republicans and Democrats to support that. Just giving additional local controls. And if the People's Republic of Ann Arbor doesn't want their teachers to be protected from terrorists that want to do harm to their children, then that's the Republic's ability to stop them from having tasers.
Well, let's talk about a bill that is in your committee, Military Veterans and Homeland Security. You're going to be taking up Darrah Rendon's House Resolution 28, which has to do with the border wall. Explain to our listeners what that is.
Yes. Congress authorized the president in the 1970s inability to move funds around to stop the pipeline of drugs from the country to our south into the United States. The Congress has refused to fund a wall to stop that. Since Congress has delegated the authority to the president to move money around for that purpose, the president has used that authority. Obviously, the Congress can withdraw that delegation of power at any time. They've also refused to do that. Unfortunately, our attorney general, instead of worrying about making sure that we follow the Supreme Court with regards to the constitutionality of no-fault insurance, has decided to join California and sue President Trump over protecting our southern border, protecting people from being human trafficking victims and things of that nature. Representative Rendon's bill would urge the attorney general to get out of that lawsuit, stop wasting the taxpayers' dollars, and worry about Michigan issues.
Now, she says, the Attorney General's office says, that there is no real money here. We just basically wrote a piece of paper and sent it over to a court somewhere far, far away. What's the harm in doing that?
Well, the problem is every time somebody in her office does something, it costs the people of the state of Michigan money. That attorney could be out there protecting the environment, could be checking in on corporations and making sure they're not breaking campaign finance law, any number of other issues, making sure that permits are moving along, things of that nature. They took time, which costs money, and diverted it from other necessary and vital functions to do a political statement to join their liberal friends in California and sue the president. A waste of time? Well, it's a waste of money.
I think it was last year or the year before, you sent me a message and you said, check out my Facebook post about getting rid of the no-fault system. Just getting rid of no-fault. Not reforming no-fault, but getting rid of no-fault and going back to tort. And I looked at your email post. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous. Going back to tort? I mean, how is he going to get support for that? And yet, why am I hearing people like threatening, like Rich Studley a couple weeks ago, saying, you know what? Maybe that's not a bad idea after
it's
all.
It's not a bad idea.
And more people are talking about this.
We always believed in the 70s, like I was there. They believed in the 70s that if we made it so you couldn't sue another driver for being in an auto accident, that court cases would fall. If we didn't have a tort system, we went into no fault, all the litigation would go away and we'd be able to sing kumbaya. You'd pay to fix your car, the guy that hit you'd pay to fix his car, and the litigation would be gone. Well, ever since then, the lawyers got wise and figured out they could sue hospitals and still could get a third of it. So after we did that, the amount of time the court spends on no faults is more than tripled percentage of the docket wise. And we've saved no money on car insurance. We've saved no money in the judiciary. In fact, both have gone up higher. So if we can't get reasonable reforms within the system, such as a fee schedule and choices, then why don't we blow the whole system up and start with the way it was in the 1970s, almost like New Jersey did.
So you're saying that this whole no-fault experiment has not worked. So
it's been an utter failure. It's been an absolute utter failure.
So when people think of high insurance rates, though, I think they automatically think of Detroit because they've been talking about this for years and years and years now. But how long has it been an issue in the UP?
It's been an issue in the UP.
It has.
The average Uper pays about $1,500 a year in car insurance prices. Now, to our friends in Southeast Michigan, that sounds like a steal. But when you go to Southwest Upper Peninsula along the border with Wisconsin, Wisconsin and Northern Wisconsin pay $500 a year for car insurance. The brain injury clinics came in before the insurance committee last term and said, if you did your reform, people would be lying on the side of the road dying in need of an ambulance. I've been in Northern Wisconsin. It's actually a pretty nice place. And I've never seen anybody lying on the side of the road dying in need of an ambulance ride because their tort system wasn't good enough to bring them to the hospital.
But they may not get the care in Wisconsin that they get here.
They get the same care. America, it's a fundamental lie that the left keeps pushing that if you don't have health insurance, you'll never get healthy. It's nonsense. If you go to any hospital anywhere in the country, they have to take care of you, regardless of your ability to pay. So we don't have a free market healthcare system. If you did, the hospitals would be able to turn you away at the door. We don't. We have socialism, a socialized system. And because of that, you always get in the door and you always get treated. In 49 states, if you run out of health insurance on your car, meaning car insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance will pay for it. Michigan's the only one in the nation that doesn't do that, and we're subsidizing everybody else's Medicare and Medicaid.
All right, so the odds of something passing in the House this year, what do you put them at, percentage-wise here?
I got to put that in 80%.
In 80%? That...
Well, I would say this. I think it's a 90% chance we get something done. I think it's a solid 75% chance we get something really good done.
Really good done.
Something really good.
That gets both sides of the aisle excited.
I don't really care about getting both sides of the aisle excited as much as saving everybody money. I wish that the Duggan-Leonard plan would have passed. It would have saved the average family $1,000 a year. Unfortunately, we could only get less than 10% of the Democrat Party to vote for it. I hope we can get both sides excited because that's what it takes to get things done. We need to get something done. We need to save the average family $1,000 a year. I don't know how we do that without choices and without a fee schedule or tort. I'm okay with that, but I'm on the Select Committee on no-fault reform or reducing auto insurance rates. There's a lot of testimony to be heard. And I really appreciate Speaker Wentworth taking his time going through this. We're going to hear from CPAN next week. And I think there's a clear directive, certainly to committee members, that you know, I can't be my usual bomb-throwing representative from the Upper Peninsula. You know, we're going to keep calm and cool on this and get something done. But I do think we need agreement on both sides of the aisle. The person that I voted for governor is not sitting in that seat. But my governor, Governor Whitmer, ultimately will probably have to sign the bill if it's to become law. So we need to make sure it is bipartisan. We need to make sure that it's thoughtful. And it might not be my preferred way of getting it done. But at the end of the day, the voters demand, and there is a mandate to get this finished, get this fixed, save the average family $1,000 a year. And we'll save, it's about $1 billion of a tax cut with no impact, no negative impact to the budget. That's a big deal.
Bo LaFave, State Representative from Iron Mountain, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you guys very much.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Representative LaFave, John, Jack, Jacob, Mike, and TJ. Now, we've got one more fun thing that I want to close out on before we end the podcast, and that is Rick Snyder's portrait is in the works right now. And it's going to take the place of a Soapy Williams portrait up in the Rotunda, which I know TJ is really upset about. But I know they'll find a place for Soapy. Don't you worry, TJ. It will still be on display as long as there are Democrats around.
That's true. I just don't want him in a closet. That's all I really want. I want Soapy Williams someplace prominent that I can go look at it every once in a while.
Maybe Ananick will want it in his office or something
or
like that.
Or outside his office. Something, I don't know. But he's a fan as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a fan, too. And I remember I go back to watching him come in for the State of the State when the State of the States were held in the afternoon and coming in as a Supreme Court judge and tan and the way he looked and everything. And it's hard to imagine him being put anywhere that's not prominent.
All right. So the question is what will be in Rick Snyder's portrait? What is one thing that we can think of is going to be in Rick Snyder's portrait? And the reason why I mention that is because the Granholm portrait I think you said, TJ, we could probably make a treasure hunt out of looking at.
Yeah, if you look at the Granholm portrait, and it's really well done, but it's like almost a national treasure kind of clue game you can play with it, where every brush stroke and every like item in it is means something. I think they'll send political science classes in the future to study it and to see what's there and to interpret it. I don't think you'll see as much of that from Rick Snyder. I think Snyder will go more for a portrait with maybe a few subtle clues in there, but not every. But if you look at the Granholm portrait, every single thing in there means something. Even like the way she's standing and the right. way she's wearing and you know where she's looking. It's. I don't think Snyder's going to put that kind of calculus into it.
I think he's going to be sitting on the bank of the River of Opportunity.
Oh. With scuba gear nearby.
There you go. That would be
good. What could he come up with that symbolize a nerd? He has to have some kind of symbolism. Where
pocket protector?
Something that shows the nerd angle. If he can figure out, I mean, you know, artists can be very creative. If he tells the artist, I want you to come up with something that shows somewhere in that portrait the nerd angle, that could be very interesting.
Does he wear a tie, Jacob?
Oh, absolutely not.
No, he can't wear a tie,
no,
can he?
Of course not.
What do you think you're going to see in there, Mike?
I strongly suggest that we have a lenticular portrait of Governor Snyder. You probably don't know what that is.
No.
Back in the 60s, they made a lot of photographs. And if you viewed them from one direction, you'd see one picture. If you viewed them from another, you'd see another.
We have some campaign buttons
like that from the 60s. Yeah.
So they're very common. You see them mostly in secondhand stores now. They were mostly pretty cheesy. We need a lenticular portrait of Governor Snyder that in one direction you see a big pile of fraudulent unemployment compensation checks. And when you look at it from the other angle, they all disappear.
And a glass of dirty water. And we know. But, you know, the only problem I have with what you're saying with that is, frankly, that should work for all politicians, not just Governor Snyder. So you may have opened up an entire, you know, area of industry here if you
like
stop and think about it.
A whole new industry.
That would be something, you know, you could take a look at the glass of water. Would the glass of water be half full or would it be half empty? What color would it be?
How about President Obama drinking from it? Remember, he came, he showed up in Flint.
Well, you know, one of the things about these portraits, especially as we move forward, is they're trying, I think governors are going to try and send subtle messages that give nods to their legacy. And I think, you know, Rick Snyder, big into, you know, balancing the budget, even though that's his job that he had to do, you know, that he'll, you know, the grand bargain in Detroit. You know, I think that he may, if he elects to go the kind of, you know, symbolic route, he'll put things in this portrait that are in line with what he believes his best frame of his legacy is. And, you know, and so the things like the unemployment compensation and Flint and other things that, you know, that people want to connect him with will be nowhere near,
right.
near that picture.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In all seriousness, that will not be in there.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if you see a guy at a desk poring over a spreadsheet.
That's awfully hard to picture.
But I think
you're right. If he does do symbols, though, you can almost see like the Detroit skyline in the back.
Not
in the back.
Flint skyline.
Right.
Yeah, Detroit skyline for sure.
Yeah, it won't be the Flint River. It'll be the Detroit skyline.
Yeah. You know. Definitely no Tyler.
No time.
I do think there'll be something. There could be something from the Detroit bankruptcy represented in there. Also, if you want to go with the nerd route, you could put a robot in there. The governor loved robots. He probably still does.
Maybe,
and that could be a nod to the guild trades push later in his term.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. It will be later this year, and we'll pull up this podcast and see how many of us were right with that. So that's going to do for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and our other podcast. Till next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.